Hello, everybody, and welcome to tonight's stream. We're live on Odyssey, Rumble, DLive, and Entropy, and I've got a wonderful panel for you here tonight to discuss the big issue of, well, the last week or so, and it's obviously Trump's war for Israel, or Trump's war on Iran for Israel, to be more precise. Now, the guys I've got with me, I'll be introducing shortly. It's, of course, Natty and Euro from the Nationalist A Team. We're going to cover some of the things we covered last Sunday quickly, and then we're going to go deeper into things. Everyone's going to get roughly an equal time to talk. I'm not going to be putting people on an egg timer, but we've probably got 9 or 10 topics. And if everyone puts sort of 3-4 minutes into each topic, it'll be about a 90-minute presentation. So stick around. It's going to be pretty entertaining, or at least pretty enlightening. You might have noticed I'm not on camera tonight. My apologies for that. It's not because I'm being rude. Slightly under the weather today, actually. I don't know whether I sound it, and if I do, my apologies, but I am doing my best to essentially be as chirpy as humanly possible, all things considered. Now, if you like this stream, please share it. If you really like this stream, please consider making a donation. Please consider contributing to my work. You can do so via Entropy and also directly through Rumble. Anything that is sent tonight, any super chat, any donation that has a message attached, the message will be read out live on tonight's stream. So we will talk about that. So if you've got a different point of view, if you've got something you want to raise, if you think we've missed something, or if you just say, look, Mark, I really appreciate the fact that you've been consistent for the last 26 years and I want to keep you fighting, even though you're banned from everywhere, I appreciate that as well. So thank you in advance for everyone who super chats. You can also donate via crypto. All the crypto links are in the description below. And finally, you can write to me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com. Although I didn't answer my emails this morning, again, under the weather. Sorry, guys. Back to things on Monday, unless I've got some kind of horrible illness that drags on past then and sort of takes me out, which I'm sure I haven't. That's quite a morbid thought. Anyway, we are going to get into it now. But before we do that, let's go round the group and we'll introduce everyone. Now, the first is, of course, Natty. You know him from the Nationalist A Team and also from numerous other streams that he's done with me in the past. Natty's a guy that's been around since the beginning of PA. He's been to all the meetings, at conferences, camps, etc. And he's always someone that everyone likes hearing from. In fact, I always say that if I had a wingman on PWR, it would be this guy here. Natty, how are you doing, my friend? I hope you are well.
Yeah, I'm good. I'm enjoying watching Tel Aviv burn. I'm sure we're going to talk about the ins and outs of what that means. But yeah, I'm good apart from that. It's been a bit of a crazy week trying to keep up with everything. And I think my wife has suffered constantly looking across at me and seeing my face buried in my phone because I'm monitoring the situation. But yeah, it's very, very interesting times.
Do you ever get it where you're out on a sort of a supposed family event and the wife's like, why aren't you paying any attention? All you're doing is sitting on the phone. What can be so important that you need to be on your phone at this family event? And you're like, look, Israel is on fire. Tel Aviv is being hit with hypersonic missiles.
It's like, honey, chill out. There's cluster munitions going off above a suburb in Tel Aviv. This is really important. I'm watching it right now. It's amazing.
Well, yeah, that's the struggle that we have. Anyway, we've also got Euro with us tonight. He's obviously famous because Euro used to do the Absolute State of Britain podcast. And again, he's a very able wingman. He has been on the Nationalist A Team, standing in for Sam. He always has good takes. He's a funny guy. And sometimes I bully him a bit, which is a little unfair, but that's because I love him and see him as like my little brother who needs the odd sort of monkey scrub and jab in the ribs. But he is like my little brother, so I still love him. Anyway, Euro, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm good. You know, I've also been keenly paying attention, watching Middle East Spectator and other such channels on Telegram. You know, I think there's a lot more censorship, obviously, during the 12-day war that was going on between Iran and Israel before. It was very much like, well, what can we believe? How much are they not showing you? And it's just that more so. You know, we see all of Iran's failures and then some, you know, things that's like disinfo. And we see all of Israel's successes and then some. And some of that's disinfo. And it's kind of hard to even know what's real.
That's a good point, actually, because just, you know, briefly, it does seem like the information blackout from Israel was way, way more intense during the 12-day war. And it seems like now because of the scope and the breadth of everything, just more is getting through, or you're able to find out more. And I'm sure this isn't true. You know, if you check the BBC or just some other like Zogrin regime outlet, you're not going to be seeing anything hitting Israel. But that's what everyone's interested in. That's what everyone wants to see. You know, how many hypersonics hit Tel Aviv this time? You know, what US asset has just been blown up by a drone in Saudi Arabia or Bahrain or wherever it is? That's what people are interested in seeing. They want to see, you know, the underdog smacking the bully in the mouth. And that's what happens when a cheap Shahed drone gets through a multi-million dollar interceptor screen and like blows up a FAD radar system or something. That's what everyone's into, right? Everyone wants to see that. No one wants to see like Iranian suburbs being like caught on fire and hit with JDAMs and hit with Tomahawk missiles, because that's just brutal civilian casualties, which is what, you know, Zog is good at.
Well, the funny thing is to see America in this war using the copy of the Iranian kamikaze drones. They've got their own basically one-to-one copy of the Shahed drone that they've now rolled out and are starting to fire back at the Iranians, because it was just like a near perfect design that they're like, we can't make any better than this. We're just going to copy it.
Yeah, you know, the grand and mighty American empire is reverse engineering third world brownoid country drones that sound like lawnmowers when they're flying through the sky. But yeah, you know, that's what America's up to these days. I mean, you can't really claim it's the European heritage stock that's like the most genius country in the world. It's just not that anymore, I'm afraid, guys.
Well, I agree, but we've got a lot to talk about. So, and we do actually have, we do have a little sort of running order as well tonight. I'm not going to read it out, but I was going to post it actually and say, look, these are all the things we'll be discussing. But, you know, there's a lot to discuss, and we're going to go through things from the start. Now, we're going to speed run some of the bits we talked about on the Nationalist A team, because for anyone who watched the Nationalist A team and enjoys it, and look, it is a banger of a stream. Except for when I get killed by somebody and get upset. But other than that, it is a good stream. And if you want to watch it, there's some takes there. And also there's the Patriarch there as well, who provides quite a lot of good comedy. Anyway, so we're going to start with the wider justification for this, because there's nowhere better to start than the official justification. Now, I've seen these videos where Netanyahu, they're sort of like compilation videos of every time Netanyahu's claimed that Iran is sort of 5 months, 5 weeks, you know, 2 years from getting the atomic bomb. And he's been doing this, believe it or not, for over 30 years. So the first example I've seen of Netanyahu saying that Iran is just moments away from like nuclear weapon capability was actually all the way back in 1995. And the reason that's interesting.
There are people dying in this war on the American side who have not been alive longer than Iran was supposedly 2 weeks away from a nuclear weapon.
That's a very good point, that is, Euro. But you get minus points for butting in. You've been told about that a little bit.
Oh, no. Someone keep a tally. Someone keep a tally.
With the wiffle bat to give you a spanking. Right. So these fake nuclear claims are interesting for two reasons. Firstly, because they are blatantly fake. It's been, to my knowledge, 31 years. And Euro does make, look, to Euro's credit, he makes a very, very good point. You know, the idea that this has been going on longer than some of the people on these American battleships have been alive is incredible. But one thing that struck me immediately with this was, I remember living through the time of the Iraq War, and at the time of the Iraq War, weapons of mass destruction became one of the most maligned phrases to have ever been used in British Parliament, to the point where if you now say weapons of mass destruction, it's sort of synonymous with war crimes, lies, and a regime that took us into what was essentially an illegal war. You know, there was no weapons of mass destruction. But one thing that shocks me is this is the kind of thing where people just seem to have either forgotten this or put it to one side. So the Daily Mail is a classic example of this. The Daily Mail is sort of the populist right wing, you know, vote reform, you know, consider voting conservative newspaper. And they were all against Blair and the weapons of mass destruction and exposing his lies and speaking out about it once it was exposed via the Chilcot inquiry. But now the Daily Mail are like, we need this war. You know, usually we're against war, but in this instance, this needs to happen. And you've got all these shill commenters in the sections underneath the Daily Mail articles in the comment sections. And they're all saying things like, oh, I'm against the war, but this is an exception. And I don't know whether these are real people, idiot boomer types, or, and that's not all boomers, but you know the sort I mean. You know the kind of person that kind of says, oh, well, I'm against the people on the small boats, but I would let the genuine refugees in. Oh, yes, and if somebody comes here and learns to speak English, well, he's as British as Yorkshire pudding, isn't he? Those sort, you know, is it one of them or is it a shill account? But I think it's really, really interesting that exactly the same justification for the attack is being used, as was used in Iraq. But Iraq and the Iraq war, retrospectively, is possibly the most maligned conflict and the conflict seen as the most unjust conflict, probably post-World War II. I'd have said that would have gone to Vietnam at one point. But Iraq seems to have, maybe because it's more recent, seems to have eclipsed that. So what do you guys think? We'll start with you, Natty. Obviously, this is what they're saying, and we're going to discuss next the real reason and what we think the real reason is. But what do you think to this sort of fake reasoning for going to war?
Well, just listening to you there, I haven't done this because I was just reminded by what you said, but I'm fairly certain if you went back to the 2000s and had a look at the lead up to the Iraq war, you, amongst the Daily Mail articles, you wouldn't find opposition to the actual war itself, because none of these publications were really opposed to it in any meaningful way, and certainly weren't like trying to rally people against the war. So you know, post Iraq war, when everyone was kind of saying what disaster it was, I'm sure the Daily Mail were jumping on board that. But even now, publications that you would think would be against the war in Iran are kind of talking around the edge of it whilst not decrying the war, and certainly not being like anti-war, like proper anti-war publications, and laying out all the connections between the Epstein regime and the people connected in it, like Mandelson and like Boris Johnson and Tony Blair and all the rest of it. But yeah, it's striking. I mean, one of the things I put in the chat earlier was that before this happened, well, okay, let me take it back a little bit. Before Iraq, the reason why the term weapons of mass destruction became such a big thing is because the media and the government, Blair's regime, spent so much time and energy trying to get public approval for it, because they obviously felt like they needed it. They needed a justification. They needed something to sell to the British people as to why it was a good idea and why it was necessary to go into Iraq. Now, that just hasn't happened this time, because I think they understand that the forces controlling the Epstein Empire, as people are calling it, which is fairly apt, simply are not in the shadows anymore. You know, this stuff has been laid out. Israel is pulling the strings, and it's pulling the strings of America, and it's, you know, America's pulling the strings of Europe, because essentially Europe is just a colony of the United States. So they don't feel they need to justify it so much. Now, obviously, there's like regime mouthpieces and stoolies like Tommy Robinson and Douglas Murray and the Daily Mail and all the rest of it, who are now going out there and running cover and trying to make this war popular, or make it so that it seems like, well, you know, it's not a job any of us want to do, but it's necessary, and we need to do this for stability and peace. But I don't think the public are buying it. And the public, for the most part, didn't buy it with Iraq, but that doesn't stop that happening. And they're not buying it with Iran either. But there hasn't been a groundswell of opposition to it in the same way as Iraq, because they haven't spent so long trying to justify it. And for a lot of people, this just came out the blue. Not for anyone who's kind of a properly properly dissident to the kind of Epstein empire. This didn't come out of the blue. This was fairly predictable, but probably just for your average person sitting at home and getting on with life, this kind of immediate blow up in the Middle East, where oil prices are about to skyrocket, petrol prices are creeping up, and we're probably about to experience an energy crisis, just came out straight out of the blue. And the justifications, unlike Iraq, are all post hoc. It wasn't a media build up to a war. It's like a media cover plot after the war has started.
What I find interesting as well is, as you say, yeah, with the Iraq thing, there was a lot of build up, and there was, you know, let's get the UN involved, let's condemn them, let's build a coalition, let's get Britain involved. But the other thing is, they never said Iraq has a nuke. It was always this nebulous weapons of mass destruction. And it's kind of like we're going to say that they have weapons of mass destruction. And that's like, you know, we will say, oh, actually, they have chemical weapons, we're going to classify as weapons of mass destruction. And we're going to hope that we can gin that up in people's minds to be like, oh, they have a nuclear weapon. And it was like, we won't explicitly state they have a nuclear weapon. We'll just try and make people think they have a nuclear weapon. And then there was the thing about they can strike us in 45 minutes with their weapons of mass destruction. But now they just come out and say they're building a nuke. It's not weapons of mass destruction. And as you say, that's because the term is just completely, completely lost all validity. You know, people, the moment they hear that, they just know it's Iraq War II. But they're not even like trying to do that lesser thing. It's kind of like what they do with racism, where you've got like the small definition and the big definition. The weapons of mass destruction is like what they do with racism. So if you're a racist, it's like you just think that different people are different and you care about your own people. Well, that's a racist. But the moment you get labelled a racist, it's like you're a supremacist who wants to murder everyone who's not you. Well, the weapons of mass destruction is, you know, chemical weapons could be a weapon of mass destruction. But the moment you get labelled with that, all of a sudden you've got nukes, you're dangerous.
Yeah, and the 45-minute claim was like they can hit the tip of Cyprus. If they drive a Scud launcher right to the edge of the Iraqi border and fire it, they might just be able to hit Cyprus. And that was translated into British headlines as
British territory. Yeah,
yeah, they can hit us in 45 minutes. Oh my God, the sky's falling. And the reality was it was Scud missiles and some sarin gas artillery shells, which have a range of about, you know, 10 or 15 kilometers, which, you know, they used in Halabja, apparently. I mean, we got trained on that in the CBR and regiment of what happened in Halabja with the sarin gas shells. But that was passed into, like you said, weapons of mass destruction. Very nebulous, easy to understand. Well, not easy to disseminate term, but very little detail and very little meaning. And, you know, you could say to people, well, they've got Scud launchers on trucks, which can, you know, fly however many kilometers it is, and they've got some sarin gas shells. But these, in terms of where the United Kingdom is and the rest of Europe, these are absolutely meaningless. And again, it was just to justify the Greater Israel project and take out one of Israel's enemies and destroy one of Israel's enemies.
Well, I was having a think about this before we started this stream, and I said to myself, you know, there is one state, there is a rogue state in the Middle East that has weapons of mass destruction. And by that, I mean a boatload of actual nuclear weapons. And they have the capability of targeting Britain.
If rumours are to be believed, then the Samson option is a real thing. And Israel is the lunatic state that has no compunction about using these things. Now, I don't know if that's a real thing or whether that's just something that gets disseminated to scare everyone. But you've got to remember, the only people who have used nukes as an actual weapon of war against living targets is the Epstein regime in the Second World War. And I don't separate the people who are running America now from those people. I mean, it's the same group of people.
If you look at the way that they behave, the way that they behave on the world stage, the way that they behave against the Palestinians, the way that they behave against the Iranians, it wouldn't be out of character for them to just lash out at everyone else for not defending them hard enough. But according to the publicly available information, they have intercontinental ballistic missiles with a range of 11,500 kilometers, which basically means they can hit everywhere on the planet, with the exception of kind of East Australia, New Zealand, and some bits of South America.
So those parts of South America where all the Nazis fled to, so unfortunately, you can't touch
the parts where Javier Milei, who's converted to Judaism, is currently in charge.
Oh, no.
And they might also not be able to quite hit Mexico, where Claudia Sheinbaum is in charge.
Oh, dear. Well, talking about the control that Jews wield, let's talk about what we think is the real reason for this. Now, I'm going to go straight out and say it. I believe the real reason for this is the Greater Israel Project. I think the Greater Israel Project is something that has gathered pace in the last few years, especially under Trump. We've seen the attacks on Gaza. We've seen the attacks on Lebanon. We've seen the fall of the Syrian regime, which was obviously heavily influenced by Israel, who were helping Islamic terrorists in the region. You know, the head chopper ones that we're told are the great threat to peace and justice and decency, yet Israel is actually supporting those people. And we've also seen Israel be involved in the fall of other regimes. Israel were famously involved, and this came out in the Chilcot Inquiry. I actually did a video on this. Israel were very famously involved with meeting, and Tony Blair admitted this under oath in the Chilcot Inquiry. He met influential Jewish leaders from the then current Israeli regime. And he said the meetings had nothing to do with military intelligence. They had everything to do with overall strategy and long-term goals. So, you know, take that as you will. But I'm taking that as they were heavily involved in getting rid of Saddam Hussein. And I think it's obviously within Israel's interest to topple almost every sovereign regime in the region. And they do this quite openly. They are doing it more openly now. They're getting away with it, sadly. And this is a blatant example of that. They're not, you know, in some ways, they haven't, although they've loosely talked about the nuke thing, like we said, Natty did make an important point that they have been less sort of, they felt it's less necessary to sell this like they sold the Iraq war. And in some interviews, members of the American regime have simply said, yeah, we just want to kill these people. We want to kill them. We want to take them out. This is about regime change. This is about Israel. And I believe it was Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, who said it was Israel who forced our hand. They began this and we are there to defend them and assist them. So when they began the attacks, we were forced into going along with it. Now, Trump then furiously denied this, but it's a very interesting admission from Marco Rubio. So I think this is all about the Greater Israel Project. And I believe that has been the driving force or the driving ideology behind the destabilization of the Middle East.
Yeah, totally. And it kind of behooves me to say this and to get people to realize that, whereas we're living kind of day to day and prices of things go up and you're worried about your children, we've been totally separated from any idea of our history and our lineage and where we've come from and where we might be going. So it's kind of hard to understand for us, the Jewish mindset. And this is a plan that's been in the making for a very, very long time, years, decades, where once Israel is created and, you know, they have a vision of the Greater Israel Project, there's a list of countries, Libya, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Egypt, and through various machinations, they've all been, one by one, they've been taken out or pacified. Egypt is basically paid off by the United States and is under the sway of Israel, has a border with Israel, but it doesn't do anything about their genociding of the Palestinians and their destabilizing and eventual collapse of the Syrian state. What happened in Libya with Gaddafi ending up with a bayonet up his bum, dragged out into the street, and the subsequent flooding of Europe with migrants, which is a kind of side issue we can get onto if you want. But all of this,
I've got that further down the line, mate. That comes at the end. If you look at the show notes, I've actually said, you know, what are the actual repercussions for this, both for, you know, the West and for the Middle East? And that's one of the things we will talk about.
Yeah, for sure. So it's clear now, I mean, in my opinion and the opinion of other people who have been following this, that the reason Trump was so heavily pushed into a second term was that the people who are running him and the Jews in Israel believed that he was the best chance of getting this done, you know, this final push to topple Iran, which basically gets rid of the last bastion of resistance to Israel. And you've got to think, well, why is Israel so hell-bent on getting rid of people who resist them? You think, well, the people who are opposing them, the only real people who are opposing them committing genocide in Gaza, Europe was on board of it. The United States was supplying them with bombs and had carrier groups in the Mediterranean. The United Kingdom, our own government, was flying surveillance flights over Gaza and letting Cyprus be used as a refueling and an airbase for Israel. So Europe was aiding in the genocide in Gaza. And it was only Hezbollah and, you know, funded via Iran that was really attacking, and the Houthi rebels in Yemen who were attacking Israel and trying to hold them account for genociding the Gazan people. And that's unacceptable for Israel to have that resistance in the region, even though the attacks on it are totally justified and it are being used as like defense against people who are being hurt and destroyed in this like brutal way by this lunatic group of people who have been squatting on the edge of a Mediterranean. So the justifications, you know, the real justification is the toppling of Iran as a coherent state. And I'll touch on this before I pass this over to Euro, but there's talk of regime change, you know, that's what they say, well, we're trying to enact regime change here, but that isn't quite true. They're not really interested in a, you know, a regime swap where they swap one regime for another. What they're interested in is total destabilization, just like with Syria, just like with Iraq, just like with Libya, where these are just failed states with, you know, tribal warlords, with like Mossad and CIA run groups running around, HTS, ISIS, all of these people, which means no coherent defense, no, you know, missile bases, no civil defense, nothing. Just a load of groups that can be, you know, you can pay this group to fight this group and, you know, you can pay these guys or stop paying these guys and just let chaos reign while Israel just expands and expands and expands and gets to do what it wants. You know, kind of reminiscent, I'll just finish on this, kind of reminiscent to how if you import millions and millions of foreign people into a small island nation, it also becomes destabilized and coherent resistance or coherent defense or coherent politics kind of become very difficult, and a very well-motivated minority can rule the lot. So there's your answer as to the real reasons for this war.
A few things I wanted to pick up on there. Just as Mark was speaking, you kept using the term regime, and that's like one of those MK Ultra trigger words that they've put in people's minds, that like regime is bad, regime is authoritarian, evil government. It was, you know, it was always the Saddam regime and the Iran regime. They're just governments. They're a different form of government. You know, some of them are more or less democratic than others, but it's like this regime thing is a trigger word. And along that same lines, Natty, you mentioned the Houthis as rebels. I think, you know, the ones that we call Houthis are pretty much just the government of Yemen now. I mean, and they have pockets of, you know, what's left of the people that they overthrew. But they're basically just the government of Yemen. They're not rebels anymore. They're not a regime. They're just that government. But obviously, this was all part of a plan. This is something that they've been going at for a very long time. They had you know, the project for a new American century, where they said we want to hit like 7 countries in 10 years. And they've basically got all of them. I mean, they wanted to get Iraq, they wanted to get Syria, they wanted to get Libya. And of course, it's neocon Jews behind it all. So that's been happening for a very long time. There's a reason why they caught a bunch of Jewish Israelis dancing on 9/11, already filming before the first plane went into those towers. You know, they were dancing around, they were happy because they knew that was, you know, the excuse that they needed to start their own genocidal campaign. And it's like dominoes falling. They get this one, then they get that one. And I mean, what happens to Libya? Gaddafi gave up his weapons, chemical weapons and things like that. And as soon as they were gone, they were like, right, well, he's defenseless. We can go in there and kill him now. So that's what they proceeded to do. And the other thing as well, like looking at what they're doing to Iran, I mean, you talked about them wanting to destabilize them. As far as I understand, because they can't really hit these military targets, they don't know exactly where all the underground bases are and where they're being launched from. So they're targeting, I mean, apart from like primary schools for girls and things like that, which they do just because they're evil and want to blow up kids when they're not abusing kids in other ways. They're just like targeting police stations and things like that, you know, just like blow up all the police stations in the country and hope it destabilizes that way. And of course, they had this gay op a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, where they tried to incite some sort of terrorist uprising in Iran, and that failed. And obviously, they wanted to coincide these two things at the same time.
But I was going to say that was obviously hilariously mistimed, right? So they fomented this terrorist uprising, and meanwhile, they haven't got all like the military assets in place to strike it. I mean, you might have a better idea of this than me, you guys, but maybe they fought in the January uprisings that they like funded all these terrorist groups to try and overthrow the government of Iran. Maybe they thought that it was still going to be going on now while they moved all these carrier groups and pulled their troops out of the Gulfoid state bases. Maybe they thought it was still going to be going on and that the Iran government was still going to be fighting these guys. But it was crushed within like a few days, right?
I have a feeling that maybe they were trying to like wait a little bit longer, but it was about to be compromised. And they thought if we don't do it now, we miss the opportunity entirely. So they had to launch it. And they spent so long getting carriers into place to attack Iran because they've had these problems with the sewage system on the Gerald Ford, which obviously some people are saying that's like a deliberate thing that soldiers or sailors have clogged the tubes on purpose to destroy the system because they don't want to go and die and be the next false flag. But they've had problems with that before, so it's not entirely out of the realms of possibility that it is sort of coincidental to some degree. But yeah, obviously, you know, that was something that delayed them. So I mean, we can be glad about that because it's meant that Iran's not facing these two things at the same time.
I'm not sure. Look, I'm not a military analyst or anything, but I'm not sure, even if the Epstein Empire, the Epstein regime, had fomented this terrorist uprising whilst they carried out this first strike against Khomeini and a little girl's school for some reason, whether if those two things had coincided, even then, whether they'd have been able to pull off this kind of toppling of the regime. It seems like...
Regime...
Look, it's the word everyone uses here. I can try, but I'm as susceptible to the MK Ultra terms as everyone else, right? I'm just not sure it would have worked, even if they had pulled it off at the same time.
Well, look, we're going to go on to that anyway, so let's move a little bit further forward because there are other things we want to talk about. Now, I think the next thing we need to talk about, we've placed this into context, talk about the Greater Israel Project. Now, I think the next thing that's very, very important is discussing the issue of these fake negotiations that America's had with the likes of Iran before all of this kicked off. And they obviously had similar sort of fake negotiations with, I think it was Venezuela, didn't they? And then they go in anyway. This is something that America started doing, you know, fake negotiations, but then we come and get you anyway.
I think they had a similar thing with the like Hezbollah and the Hamas, didn't they?
Yeah, there's multiple examples. But what I'm getting at is, this is a real, and we won't labour this because we spoke about this extensively on the Nationalist A team the other night. But when we were talking about that, we did make the point that fundamentally, at one point, the idea of going in somewhere, you know, negotiating, but then using negotiations as a reason or as an excuse to then hit another country. So the negotiations aren't real negotiations. They're cover that gets the other side to drop their guard. So, you know, it's like walking up to somebody in a bar and saying, look, mate, let's just settle this amicably. Let me buy you a drink. What do you want? And when the other guy turns to have a look at the, you know, the list of craft beers, you sucker punch him. You know, that's an underhanded thing to do. Everyone would be like, wow, that's pretty much, you know, scandalous. We don't want to see that kind of behavior. That's the kind of behavior that's not becoming of an honorable man. And there used to be this narrative that the West was honorable, that we were the good guys. And I'll say these fake negotiations are being used as a means to cover up an attack which is imminent. I do think that is a really, really shady thing to do. And I think that as time goes by, we are going to see more and more people be unwilling to negotiate with the West. Like, why would Vladimir Putin or China or any other nation, North Korea, negotiate with Trump? Why would any foreign leader trust going to America or sitting in a negotiation room with the Americans when they assassinate leaders, carry out fake negotiations, use the hand of friendship to lock their opponent's hand in place before they sucker punch them? You know, it's like holding one hand out to shake the other guy's hand, and when he starts giving the handshake, you just sucker punch them. You know, it's awful. I mean, what do you guys think to this? I think this is going to fundamentally change the way, the implication of this is going to change the way that every other nation does business with America. And it'll put America on a, you know, even people like the Europeans, who are essentially vassal states of America, are not going to be trusting of Trump again or America.
Well, Europe is already not going to be trusting of Trump and America because of the whole thing with Greenland, for a start. But I mean, I hope at the end of this, obviously, Iran's going to hold out. They're going to continue to resist until America and Israel.
This is the summation. What you hope for comes at the end. Like, stay on.
It's related to this. I was going to say, I hope that, you know, Israel and America run out of interceptor missiles. Iran fights them to a standstill and they say, right, we will negotiate with Trump in this place. He goes there to negotiate.
And then they just blow him up.
Right on top of him. And it would be entirely justified on moral grounds and on, you know, the grounds that it's already been done to them.
They would cry bitter tears if the same tactics they had used, these same underhand, cowardly, snivelling, weak tactics, were used on them. And this is something to point out to I say, you know, I'm going to use boomer, but like boomer mindset, Civnat, the kind of Tommy Robinson tard mindset, where like, oh yeah, no, we're the good guys and we should stamp these dirty terrorists into the ground, they're terrorists. It's like, your like pedo Jew empire assassinates little girls for some reason, you know, I guess because they've just got bloodlust, and we can talk about the Purim fest if we want, assassinates little girls, assassinates world leaders, which is supposed to be off the table, totally violates like any notion of the Geneva Convention or the kind of rules of war, and does it in like a cowardly way. This is like your, you know, your medieval knight marching out to the front of a battle under a white flag to negotiate terms, and then just pulling a knife and stabbing the negotiator. That's not a you know, your entire army would be there like forfeit, and the enemy army would be totally justified in just slaughtering prisoners and like just pillaging and doing whatever it wants at that stage. You know, you've set the rules. You're supposed to be the powerful, the one who's setting out exactly how things are going to go down, and you open the conflict, or the latest round of the conflict, with an underhand, cowardly assassination under the flag of truce and blowing up 170 schoolgirls. Well, I'm sorry, but what space have you now given for quarters? None. And no one's going to trust you, and they shouldn't trust you. And the other world powers looking on, you know, Russia and China, who we're going to touch on in a little while, like Mark said, they're not going to be trustworthy. They're going to have that in their minds. Anytime America tries to talk to them, anytime the Jew Empire reaches out to say, oh, we just want to discuss the Ukraine war and negotiate terms in the Ukraine war. And like Euro said, they would be totally justified in shooting down like diplomatic planes, like bombing like delegations, peace delegations, assassinating the head of state. Who's to tell anyone now that that is a wrong or immoral thing to do, now that supposedly the world police and the global superpower and the most moral army in the world, Israel, has carried out exactly that, such a thing? You know, and you don't need to belabor the point, but they've been doing this for a long time, and you can look back as far as Dresden and the nuclear bombs dropped on Japan to say, well, that's how these people act, and people who oppose them should act accordingly and plan accordingly.
Well, I agree, and not only this, or not only what you guys have said, but I do think it's very, very interesting that on top of everything you guys have said, there is also the issue of Russia and Zelensky. Now, obviously, if Russia had wanted to, they could have bombed Kiev day one of the conflict and absolutely just beheaded the regime. Now, Russia never did that. Now, I'm not saying Russia are the good guys or shilling for Russia, but it is an interesting comparison to see that everything that Russia has been accused of, the West has done, and the West has done it in a much more sort of egregious fashion. It's quite interesting. And this so-called axis of evil now appears to be far less evil than the good guys. The good guys have shown, I say that in inverted commas, have shown their, you know, their hand. They've, you know, it's a mask off moment. I don't know if anyone wants to add something to this, because we did talk about this a lot, but I'll give you the chance to follow up if anyone wants to talk about this.
Yeah, go on, Euro. You go first.
I was just going to say, it's, you know, it's a complete moral inversion. It's, we are supposedly the good guys because we fight against the bad guys, and they're all terrorists. They're inherently evil. I was listening to, I think this was on the Daily Shower, they were talking about basically the term terrorist is a social construct. It's just a word we can use to label somebody, and all of a sudden, you know, their grievances illegitimate, we don't have to stick to the rules of engagement, we can just murder them, we can murder their families, we can put them in jail, we just put this label on them and they are inherently evil. But you know, the Ayatollah was never in the Epstein files. That's the difference.
Yeah, the Ayatollah never called me a goyim or demographically replaced my people or ethnically cleansed my people, so you know, what beef do I have with the Ayatollah at this point? And like Mark was saying, the Russians opened Ukraine, the Ukraine conflict, by striking out military targets. They were landing at Hostomel airport and controlling like major supply routes, and the Jew-pedo regime starts its war with an assassination of a leader, or a spiritual leader, not a military strategist or anything like that, a spiritual leader who's in his 80s, as well as his granddaughter and his family members all blown up. And like blowing up a school with, you know, 12 to 17 year old schoolgirls in it. Now you tell me who the bad guys are.
It's worth pointing out as well that the entire war in Ukraine, although it was something that had been kind of slowly building up for a while, that NATO had been expanding further and further eastward. It was really brought to the fore because Russia was supporting Assad in Syria, and the Epstein Empire had to take out Syria in order to stop Iranian weapons getting to Hezbollah and getting to Gaza. And so they started this whole other conflict to take Russia's focus away from helping their allies in Syria. And that allowed them to get in there and destroy Syria. And it's all part of the same program.
The same grand strategy. Yeah, a lot of people kind of don't seem to understand that, how they're like, well, that seems too far-fetched that the pedo-Jew regime would start a war with Russia in Ukraine just to help topple the Syrian government, or the pedo-Jew regime would kidnap a South American president just to support an ongoing or support a future war against Iran with oil routes and all the rest of it. Because people are like, no, that can't be right. 50,000 Ukrainian men dead, and God knows how many Russian men dead, just to tie up Russian forces to leave Syria exposed. It's like, yeah, that's how these people think. That's what they're willing to do. And that's what they did do. And, you know, Syria, Russian troops, Russian air power in Syria was halting Israeli aggression and, you know, Western aggression. It was the CIA, it was MI6, and it was Mossad that was paying ISIS, which has now become HTS, which is basically ISIS, to mess up Syria and mess with Assad and sanctions on Assad's government that was turning the place inhospitable, you know, making it so that just to live there was pain. And it wasn't, you know, the government was obviously suffering and trying its best, but the people suffer when you put sanctions on a country. So on behest of like Jewish pedophiles and Israel, America just makes people's lives a misery around the world, everywhere. You know, Ukrainian men dead, Syrian families wiped out, little girls in Iran, hundreds of thousands of civilians everywhere in Iraq, in Gaza, in Libya, all dead because Jewish pedophiles just cannot get enough blood.
And to the extent that they have any support for the Israeli regime in places like the UK, people in the UK who support Israel, they see this as a war against the Muslims. And they hate Muslims because of what gangs of Pakistani men do to white girls after Jewish people like Peter Mandelson and his friend Tony Blair, people like that, brought them to our country. And, you know, it works for them both ways, because it destroys the youth of the British people. It destroys our homogenous country. It creates resentment against Muslims, which they can then use and say, well, don't you hate the Muslims? You hate the Pakistanis who are raping children over here.
Yeah, live vicariously as we bomb them in the Middle East. Oh, we're getting those dirty Muslims for you, you know, Goyim. Don't worry, we're bombing them. You love it, don't you? Rah, rah, let's go, Israel. Israel's defending. If we weren't fighting them here, you'd be fighting them in your streets. Well, thanks, Shlomo. How did they get onto my streets in the first place? And you don't fancy answering that question?
No, that's a very, very good point. Now, obviously, we discussed that. So when we've discussed the Ayatollah being killed, we've discussed the schoolgirls being killed. I mean, you know, as you said, the paedophiles are now murdering children. And this says something about America and Israel. Now, I don't think this was an accident. I don't think that school being hit was in any way an accident. I think they did that on purpose. I think that's the sort of people that they are. I think they do things like this because it pleases them to do things like this, and it pleases them to do things like this because to them this is you know, they could have avoided doing this, but they don't want to avoid doing this. What they want to do is they want to cause as much hurt and pain as possible. Now, these missile systems that they have, they are probably the best missile systems in the world. They understand where they can strike, where they can't strike. Those missiles are pretty damn accurate. So when they hit a school, I think that's by some sort of sick design. I don't believe it's accidental. I don't know if you guys want to add anything to that.
Yeah, there's a term called sub-meter accuracy, and I think Tomahawk missiles, I'm not sure about JDAMs, but certainly Tomahawk missiles and the types of missiles that the Juppedo regime uses all have sub-meter accuracy. So the claims about, well, this girls' school was next to a Iranian military base or something, these munitions have sub-meter accuracy, which means they can target within a meter, which is where they drop these bombs. I mean, are we supposed to pretend that the pedo-Jew regime is somehow like squeamish about blowing up children and civilians? A regime that, you know, goes out of its way to target hospitals and suburbs, and then when it's blown up the hospitals and suburbs, then blows up the tent cities that spring up around it to house all the refugees and injured people that you've just like totally displaced. So these people are not squeamish about killing civilians, and they never have been. They never have been, not for the last 70 years and probably not before that.
We're always told that we have the most advanced, precise, ultra accurate munitions. You know, we can take out a terrorist in a crowd without killing anyone else. Oh, look, we dropped a bomb dead center on that school. Total accident. You know, we don't know how it happened. Do you remember, you know, when they were attacking Gaza? I mean, they're always attacking Gaza, but in particular, in the aftermath of October 7th, and there were various organizations that went there to try to provide food relief. And they had a car with a big logo on the top that says, you know, Food Kitchen. It's a non-governmental organization. It's a charity that's bringing food to starving people in Gaza. And they sent a munition. It's like a missile, but instead of a bomb, it's got just like razor blades all around it. And you can see the picture of the car. They sent it straight through the roof, directly on top of the driver's seat, and cut that man to bits. That's how accurate they can be when they want to be. So they have the ability to do that. They have the ability to do it. It is not an accident when they don't.
The other interesting thing about the strike on the girls' school was that in the immediate aftermath, like, there were shills online. There were online shills and rightoids and Jews and all sorts of like scum coming out the woodwork, claiming, again, like they used to do in Gaza, or like they have done in Gaza, that this was an Iranian missile that kind of missed a target or misfired as they fired it out of Tehran and fell back on the girls' school, which was utterly disproved. And yet, you know, none of the people who were claiming this was like an Iranian misfire will ever be held to account or ever be made to apologize or made to like confront their lies, then the lies about what this was. You know, so the misinformation is hot and heavy, but if you think, like I said, I'm going to reiterate this, if you think the pedo-Jew regime is squeamish about blowing up children, you're mistaken. They're not squeamish about blowing them up. They're probably the only disappointing thing for the pedo-Jew regime is that these girls were blown up and didn't have a chance to be like sent off to Epstein's Island or something like that.
Thank you. The next thing is, this is quite interesting because it's not the first time that Israel have admitted to bombing civilian populations, and we've discussed that. They did it in Lebanon. They do it quite indiscriminately. They do it in Gaza. But one thing's quite interesting about these particular bombings, and you guys made the point that they were bombing police stations, and I think they believe that if they bombed police stations and took out government leaders and spiritual leaders, that there was going to be a revolution. And we've constantly heard this nonsense in the West, haven't we? That the Iranian regime is hideously unpopular, that normal people in Iran hate the Ayatollah, they hate the government, the police, every organ of the state. I'd actually say more people in Britain hate Keir Starmer than people in Iran hate the Ayatollah. But one thing that's been very interesting is post these strikes and these indiscriminate missile attacks on schools, police stations and other sites around Tehran, we've seen more people out in the streets supporting the Iranian government and wanting to fight back against America. I think that really underlines the fact that this idea that the Iranian people are all kept down, they have the Ayatollah's boot on their head, this is nothing more than propaganda.
Oh, of course. It's quite interesting to juxtapose it. Can you imagine like a protest or a march with hundreds of thousands of people ever coming out for any European government? I mean, the closest you got in the West was Trump, right? And, you know, that has quickly turned to ash in a lot of people's mouths. He's been exposed as basically just another neocon. But if you put yourself in the shoes of like an Iranian, you know, a normal Iranian citizen who's just watched every single country where, you know, his kind of ethnic people, I know that Persians have maybe looked at differently than other people in around the Gulf states, whatever. All the other countries around him who aren't in league with Israel have been like brutally broken up and just left as failed states. Well, you're going to want to cling to anything that stands up to these people and anything that resists being destroyed by them, because you know that if your government falls, that's the end of any like semblance of stability or normality you've got. You're just going to have to either flee or deal with a failed state of a nation. So of course they support them. And you listen to like the BBC or Piers Morgan or some of these shows, and you would think that like
Andrew Neil,
the
worst.
He is the worst. He's a total like Zio bootlicker, man. I'm surprised he hasn't drowned in Jewish semen. But like, you listen to these people, and you'd think that every single person in Iran is just waiting, crouched behind their door, ready to rise up and take out this hugely unpopular government that everyone hates. And like you said, there's no government in Europe or anywhere in the West that is as popular with its people as the Iranian government. So, you know, take that as you will.
Obviously, you know, Iran, I'm guessing, but much like most of the Middle East, is awash with weapons from previous gay ops and, you know, plans that we've had to overthrow them in the past. But if you turn this around and let's say some foreign actor blew up Parliament with every MP in it and blew up every diversity police station across the country and just dropped a bunch of weapons, you know, the chance of having a revolution would be much more likely here than it ever would be over there.
Yeah, and you know, just to add on to this point, funnily enough, the strikes on Bahrain, and Bahrain's a tiny little island nation. I mean, it used to be part of Iran, but the strikes on Bahrain look like they might actually foment a revolution, because the kind of the pedo-Jew empire installed monarchy in Bahrain has lost its grip thanks to the Americans retreating, and the actual people in Bahrain absolutely hate their rulers. And it, you know, possibly you know, news blackout and all the rest of it might actually foment a popular revolution in Bahrain and change governments there, which is supposed to be like a stronghold for the American empire and the Epstein regime, and the headquarters of like the Fifth Fleet, which controls the like the Persian Gulf, or it used to control the Persian Gulf until the pedo Jew regime started this war. So yeah, good one, guys. How's it going? How's this war going for you?
Well, I would say that you've got a very good point there. It's a good point, because we are moving on to how is this war going. Well, this is the interesting thing. Trump was elected as the guy who was going to be the president of peace, and he was also elected on this America First ticket, the idea that he was going to look after the average American. Now, since Iran has closed the Strait of Hormuz, we've seen sort of panic buying, oil prices have spiked. This is something that isn't helping normal Americans who are already struggling with Trump's idiotic tariffs. And I would say for Trump, when you actually look at, you say, how's it going for him personally? Well, it's not going well domestically, but his approval ratings are at an all-time low. They're actually beneath his previous approval ratings for his first term and actually beneath Biden's approval ratings now. He's getting savage. Now, obviously, he's going out on TV. Oh, none of these mean anything. This is rubbish. The people love me. And I've spoken about this before. Post-World War II, I don't think any Western leader has built a cult of personality as intense as Trump has done with the MAGA movement. Trump has truly built a cult of personality where people see him as the supreme leader. But I think that can be a good thing and it can be a bad thing. It's a good thing because you have a dedicated support base. It's a bad thing because often you become insulated and you only listen to that dedicated support base. And because you have that insulation, because you have that ring of people cheering you on and like, up Trump, yeah, you're doing it right, you're getting it right, Donald's got it, perfect, bomb them all. You don't actually hear the people outside of your immediate circle. And I think Trump has got this wrong. I think this is going to bring more misery on normal Americans. And I also think it could cost the Republicans the midterm.
I don't think Trump got this wrong. I think Trump did this because his handlers wanted him to do this. I mean, was it Marco Rubio who basically came out and said, Israel told us they were going to attack, and when they attacked, we were going to get hit in response, so we just had to join them, basically. The tail wags the dog. We had to join in. They forced our hand. And, of course, Trump's all over the Epstein files. He's part of the Epstein class. He is part of that Jewish Zionist-occupied government. He's not doing it because he thinks it's going to make him popular. He's doing it because he is either severely compromised or that's just his team.
Yeah, and I, you know, to assume that Trump cares anymore, I mean, he's not up for a third term. And if he doesn't care, do you think his Jewish, the Jews who are running him, and the Epstein, whoever takes over from Epstein, cares about Trump's reputation or cares even less about the American people and what they want? They were just dupes who were fooled into voting for him. And you can say, well, the 2016 Trump train, which was a lot more based and had a lot more kind of like groundswell right-wing energy behind it. Well, they were tricked as well, right? But, you know, if you fell for it again and voted for him this time, they really, you know, must despise you and just think you're the most stupid person ever going. And it's been proven right. I mean, Trump has now burned any credibility he's had. This is an extremely unpopular war, but it doesn't matter. His reputation isn't on the line anymore, and it's not a consideration for the people pulling his strings. They wanted this war done. Trump was their best shot of getting it done, and so they've got him to enact it, and what we're seeing is the fallout. And you know, who knows where this ends? I'm sure we're going to move on to that point, but the suffering of the American people, the suffering of European people is not any concern to these people. And you might argue that European suffering and, you know, American suffering is just a little bit of icing on their cake.
This is something that they've wanted for decades, and they've realised that as time's gone on, it's getting less and less possible. So they've done it now, because now is more likely than tomorrow. You know, as bad as it is, and as badly as they're, you know, doing and not winning like they want to be, if they'd waited longer, they would have had even less chance. So it's just like, it's do or die, it's all out now, because they've got no other choice.
Right, yeah, that's what I'm, you know, I totally agree with that. And what I'm saying is, the considerations that like a rational government that cared about its people would make, you know, and there's going to be an energy crisis. Our people are going to die in this war. It's hugely unpopular. This doesn't benefit us in the slightest. None of that is in consideration. And it's clear when you listen to people that they don't quite understand that. And you listen to like the media class trying to justify this war and just grasping for anything. Whereas like the reality, the truth that this is purely for Israel and purely for like the pedo Jew empire, just doesn't, you know, is quite a hard pill to swallow.
And as always, it's going to affect Europe and it's going to affect the UK so much worse than it's going to affect America, because America has its own energy supplies, whereas, you know, Europe has been deliberately cut off from Russian energy supplies and, you know, made to not take fuel from Iran in the first place. And so Europeans are probably going to freeze this winter because of what the Americans have done.
Or what the Jewish American Empire has done.
Yeah.
Not content with cutting off via a Jewish pedo regime war with Russia, not content with cutting off like the majority of European energy supplies. Now the pedo Jew empire now starts another war in the Gulf, which will just totally screw energy prices. And you guys know this, but I'm in the middle of, I've almost finished building my house, and part of that was installing a heating system, and we've got a central heating system.
You didn't install a heat pump, did you, Natty?
We did not install a heat pump. We installed a central heating oil boiler, which we needed to run up as like commissioning the system, and we went to fill it up the day after this started, and the price of central heating oil was like 63p a litre. And the day after this thing started and Iran closed the Strait of Hormuz, it went up by like 33p a litre. And it's now at like £1.33 a litre. So, you know, I know this isn't funny because this is going to affect everyone, but it's like these are real effects. And no, you know, the people who started this war just don't care about this. And you haven't felt this at the pumps yet, but my God, like you are going to, and the whole of Europe is going to. So,
and it will be white pensioners who freeze whilst illegal migrants can turn up the heating as much as they want in hotels, you know, and non-whites all over will get preferential benefits and help to make sure that they're looked after while our people suffer.
That's a given at this point. But yeah, we're about to be hit with this thing. I mean, unless it wraps up quickly, which is not going to happen.
Yeah. Even if it did wrap up tomorrow, we'd still have the price shocks. I mean, this is what always happens when there's a, like, the price of oil shoots up, petrol prices shoot up, the price of
two,
oil
two days
down,
for it to rise 100%, and then six weeks for it to creep its way back down, yeah.
They're very interesting points, and obviously it sort of goes into what we said before about Venezuela. It puts everything into context. Now, one of the things that is really, we're going to talk a bit about the fight back here and what Iran has done, its retaliatory strikes. But one of the most disappointing things is they talk about this axis of evil. But so far, Russia have condemned this. I'm not sure what China have said, if anything at all. But there's largely a wave of silence about this, isn't there? There isn't sort of the international. So when Russia started their, in inverted commas, they're not my words, but they're their words, the special military operation, you know, there was this wave of condemnation from every European country about, you know, the invasion of Ukraine. However, here, this so-called axis of evil, China, Russia, etc., there doesn't seem to be much in the way of pushback other than, you know, a couple of snappy press statements. And I think this does tell you something about Russia and China's ability or readiness to get involved. Now, I would say China is more concerned with potentially taking Taiwan. And the knock-on effects of this is, well, China will look and say, if America can take out the leadership of countries they don't like, why can't we do the same to Taiwan? And I think Russia is still tied up in Ukraine, which is probably by design. I think part of the issue with Ukraine was pulling Russia so deep into Ukraine that it depleted their resources in places like Syria. So regimes did fall in areas that America and Israel wanted them to fall. But what do you think about the lack of sort of international pushback on this?
It's obvious that the Chinese and Russians are helping the Iranians in terms of intelligence gathering, satellite imagery. Supposedly the Iranian missiles use like an encrypted Chinese GPS as opposed to the American-run satellites. But yeah, they're not coming out and publicly saying a lot. and they could be doing a lot more kind of out in the open. And, you know, if they were really serious, the Chinese and Russians could help the Iranians develop an actual nuclear weapon to allow them to have a deterrent to defend themselves. And that could have happened, you know, within the last decade. But we don't see them doing it.
Well, I made this point to Mark the other day. I this is where I kind of disagree with you a little bit. I think there's only so much they can do. And, you know, Russia can't just import a nuke into Tehran or into Iran without them asking for it. And, you know, if you've been paying attention...
Well, they should ask for it then.
Well, that's maybe you're right. And yeah, they probably should. And they probably will if they get through this thing in one piece. But Russia has to be asked to provide that nuke. And the Ayatollah Khomeini has, you know, famously had a fatwa on acquiring nuclear weapons, which, you know, looking back to how we opened this thing, puts lie to the fact that Iran is 2 weeks away from having a nuke. Iran is 5 weeks away from having a nuke for the last 30 years, every couple of weeks. So for one, Iran has to ask these countries for things. And I'm fairly certain that Russia is providing military assistance, you know, maybe not flashy supersonic missiles and all the rest of it, but you know, it's a short hop across the Caspian Sea for Russia to send boats and send equipment down to Tehran as much as it can. Like you said, Mark, they're tied up in Ukraine as per the PEDOG regime's plan. And like you said, Euro, they're using encrypted Chinese satellite data for their missiles. And I'm sure, like, satellite imagery of the surrounding Gulf states and areas that Iranian, like, ballistic missiles and drones are hitting is provided by the Chinese. So I think Russia and China understand the stakes here and understand, you know, that if Iran falls, or we're kind of at a turning point in history of, like, the future of the PEDOG regime empire, and where it stands, and if it manages to pull this off and destroy Iran, then who knows what's next. And I guess we can talk about that, but for Russia and China, they probably think that actually halting the PEDOG regime here is probably a good thing to do, and as much as they can do under the table, they're going to do. And if it gets any hotter than that, well, who knows. But I disagree with you that they're not helping as much as they could be.
I don't expect them to, you know, hand over a dozen nuclear weapons and say, here you go. But why is Iran using such an antiquated air force instead of more modern Russian fighter planes, for example? Like, things like that would not be outside of the realm of possibility.
But, well, because that's not where the Iranian, like, national defense has been focused. America, whatever you like to say about it, dominates the air, and it always has the most advanced and the most airplanes that it can put in the sky, you know, carrier groups all over the place, air bases all over the place. And Iran has had a long time to prepare for this. They've watched what's happened around them and has decided, actually, our best national defense is in, you know, this missile capability and drone capability. And if Russia sent a squadron of, like, Su-22s or whatever the latest MiGs are, they would probably be shot down in fairly short order, which would be, you know, a waste of resources. So I think this idea, like I said, I think this idea that they're not helping as much as they can is misplaced. And interestingly enough, Arab Natsok in the chat has just said Iran has a hyperfixation on self-sufficiency. And he says it's noble, but it's not always the best way. And I think that's probably correct. Like I said, you can't, it's not up to China and Russia just to, you know, unload at the docks in some port somewhere, just tons and tons of military hardware that Iran never asked for. You know, they've got to agree these things, and they've got to ask for it, and they've got to trade for it and give things away. And they probably feel they don't need to. And, you know, judging by what's happening so far, maybe they're right. They didn't need it. Maybe whatever they've asked for, they're utilizing, and anything they haven't asked for, they don't really need.
I'm sorry, comrade. I didn't mean to leave that pallet of nuclear weapons there. You can do what you like.
Yeah, I did say this in all fairness, mate. I think I did say to you, it would probably deal to do something like this or to create a deal of that sort, you would probably actually need for the Iranian regime to fundamentally turn round and say, look,
regime.
You're going to have half of our country. You're going to have, X amount of our oil production. You're going to be able to put your own bases on our soil. You're going to have this power over us. And then Russia or China might say, well, this is actually worth it then. You know, we will put bases on your soil. This is absolutely worth it. We're going for it. Thanks a bunch, guys. You know, this works. But the Iranians might not actually want that. They might not actually want Russia and China to have that much control over Iranian politics or the Iranian.
Absolutely, yeah, that's absolutely right. And if you think about it, that would turn Iran into a not exactly a vassal state, but as a like an arm of Russia or an arm of China. Whereas if they come out of this unscathed, they emerge as the regional power in the Middle East, which has much bigger implications for them and makes them bigger on the world stage than just being an outpost of Russia or China.
But they could trade on more equal terms with the North Koreans. And the North Koreans have come out and said, if they ask for a nuke, they'll get one. So,
well, you know, maybe they will. I suspect the Iranian government is going to be much more looking at that idea much more favorably after this.
Well, that is an interesting point. And ultimately, I've said this on many streams, but we are in a situation where that is the only way that you can keep America off your back. That's the only reason North Korea didn't fall. It's the only reason Russia probably hasn't been invaded or struck by the Americans. I think if Russia didn't have nukes, undoubtedly America would have attacked them. But despite them not having nukes, I will say this, I think the Iranians' retaliatory strikes have been extremely impressive. But amongst those retaliatory strikes, it is noted that, because when this all started, I was thinking, why are they bombing refineries? Why are they attacking refineries in other Arab nations? Surely that's going to annoy, you know, potential allies. Why would they do such a thing? You know, we don't do that, guys, because if you do, you're going to end up being a pariah state. And, you know, your next door neighbors aren't going to want to, you know, essentially work with you. And then the other day it comes out that effectively what you're seeing here is not Iran striking these oil refineries, but the strikes on the oil refineries have been carried out by Israel. So what do you think to Iran's actual retaliation? And what do you think of Israel's rather underhanded attacks? Because, and this isn't just sort of theory crafting, we've actually seen over the last 24 hours scores of Mossad agents being arrested around the Middle East for being involved in false flag operations in numerous Middle Eastern nations. And of course, this is something that we all know happens. This is something that we all are completely aware of. You know, we know that Israel is regularly involved in sort of false flag events. This is something that has happened many, many times in the past. And I think it's interesting that this is being exposed. So, you know, we've had the USS Liberty. We've had bombings in the Middle East. We've had terror attacks in inverted commas in numerous countries, which have turned out to be the work of Israeli agents. And we're seeing that again now. So I think Iran has performed far more ably than people might have thought. Sadly, they don't seem to be winning this. Their navy seems to be taking major hits. But some of these retaliatory strikes that look questionable are actually the work of Israel.
Well, supposedly, I mean, who's to say that the attack on our base in Cyprus was actually carried out by Iran, because didn't Keir Starmer say, oh, we won't actually engage in hostile actions, we'll only defend Israel with our planes, which is, of course, a kind of schizophrenic point of view in the first place. But then all of a sudden, oh, look, so our base in Cyprus is attacked, and now we can kind of get in fully without restriction. So that's a good point.
I mean, we can talk about RAF Akhetiri, but if you look at where Cyprus is on a map, any Iranian weapons, munitions, whether it's drones or missiles or whatever, have to fly over, like directly over Israel. So there's speculation it was like Hezbollah or possibly someone else, or even maybe an Israeli false flag, which is, you know, certainly possible, and you know, who can say. But it does seem like the refineries in Saudi Arabia and Qatar are Mossad operations to blow them up, with the point being to try and engage those countries on behalf of Israel to come into the war on behalf of Israel and do what they can or do more for Israel. But coming back to your point, Mark, about the strikes that Iran have carried out, I'm not clear that it's not clear to me that they're losing. I mean, it seems they're losing. I'm not sure that's totally true. And we spoke about this before, you know, I think a few months back on the Nationalist A team, where I think they're doing much more, they're doing a much more capable job than anyone expected them to in the sensibility and where they're striking. So they're hitting US bases in these Gulfoid states, you know, Bahrain and Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And they're forcing the Americans to retreat, which stretches their logistic lines. And like we said earlier, they may have fomented an uprising in Bahrain. And they're making these Arab states, which have been paid off or controlled by Israel in some way, unstable and shaky. And, you know, the Israeli-installed governments and monarchs and regimes in these countries are looking incredibly shaky, or shaky as you've just put in the chat there, Hero. They're on shaky ground, and hitting Dubai, well, that's just popular with everyone in the entire world. Yeah. So what can you say about that?
It's almost like their own kind of Samson option, except inherently justified and not evil, because they're only going after the American bases and the people supporting the Americans and the Israelis. But, you know, they've said, we're attacked from here, we're going to take this, and just kind of everything in the region, every American base. And it's entirely justified because, you know, these countries can't claim to be not involved. Oh, yes, we're not involved in this. We just have a base where, you know, your enemy is launching attacks on you, but we're not involved. And then the moment Iran says, OK, well, we're not going to attack you, we're not going to attack your people, but we'll take out that base. And then say Saudi Arabia, so we're under attack, we're being attacked. Well, no. That's American soil.
That's American soil there, buddy. It's a totally legitimate target by anyone's standards.
I mean, it seems like Iran is taking a kind of tank and turtle strategy. You know, it's like when you play a strategy game and you can put a lot into units, or you can just build up your base and wait for them to come to you. And it can be risky because, you know, there's a possibility that you get overwhelmed. But if you're turtle enough, you know, you can withstand that storm, and then you can turn around and overrun.
Is Euro the tank or the turtle? That's the question.
Depends what he's had to eat.
They're turtling and tanking. It's like kind of the same thing.
But the I think like Iran by its like geography is kind of is able to naturally turtle, and the fact is that there's so many assets that America have placed around it and the Jupedo regime have around it. And the fact that Israel is within striking distance means it can strike effectively. And America is very powerful and has a very powerful military, but that military still has logistical concerns and still has aircraft carriers that are clogged with fat Mexican sailors poo.
So American aircraft carriers are as full of shit as Donald Trump.
Well, yeah, yeah. Agreed.
Well, that's the thing. Look, I mean, we haven't seen an aircraft carrier at the bottom of the Persian Gulf yet, have we? Now, you might be saying, oh, well, Mark, that's a big ask, you know, because obviously if that happened, we would actually probably see the beginning of World War III, because at that point, I think Trump would have to put boots on the ground. It actually might be the end of him. You know, it'd be one or the other, wouldn't it? He'd either have to put boots on the ground or it'd be the end of him. But we are yet to see an aircraft carrier effectively being scrapped. Now, that doesn't mean they're not doing anything in retaliation, but they're not, you know, hitting the big targets. And look, we've had American commentators, some of these American commentators that, you know, do these sort of big takes on these things. You hear them talking about this axis of resistance and saying, oh, you know, the time will come when, you know, these hypersonic missiles are going to be putting, you know, aircraft carriers at the bottom of the Persian Gulf. We're yet to see that, are we? I mean, we're also yet to see any of these sort of hypersonic super weapons take out leading members of the Israeli government or the Israeli regime. You know, I know Yuri doesn't like the word regime, which we keep using, but that is an interesting point. We haven't seen Israel struck. You know, Israel has been proved to be not invincible. I think it's fair to say that. But we haven't seen the Israeli government reeling in the same way that the Iranian government has.
Well, there's a couple of points to make here. First off, with regards to the aircraft carriers, the American Navy has been keeping the aircraft carriers at a much greater range than they would normally use them to attack somebody because they are scared of those missiles. And the Iranians have launched small salvos of kind of like four missiles at a time at them and got them to basically back off and back off to a greater distance, which means they can do much fewer kind of bombing runs at once. And they you know, more fuel requirements and greater maintenance on the planes. So it is diminishing America's capability to attack. There was also satellite footage, I think, from a Chinese satellite that showed a fire on one of the destroyers in one of the aircraft carrier's escorts. So potentially that was hit by Iranian missiles and, although not sunk, caught fire. So they're keeping them at bay. The Americans know if they get any closer, they will be hit. And with regards to the missiles that they're firing, it seems like they've used a lot of their kind of crappier munitions and their older munitions. Like everything they've been launching at the other Gulf states is short-range ballistic missiles that don't have the range to go anywhere else. So they might as well use them on these targets. And they've been using up these older, less advanced munitions.
And drones.
Yeah. And still, you know, still getting like so many interceptors wasted before they actually bring out the big guns. And we've seen within the past day or two, they're starting to launch these missiles. I can't remember the name of them, but they're like a very large cluster munition that drops about 60 different submunitions on the way down, and they're dropping those on Israel. And as I said in the very beginning, we just don't know how much is actually getting through and how much damage they're actually doing because it's sensors and covered up.
Yeah, you got to, you know, we did touch on this, and like you said, like an interceptor system, like a FAD or like a Patriot battery or whatever, costs like in the millions, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, and they're being used up by like drones with lawnmower engines and like a few kilogram warheads, and Iran's just like churning these things out, like churning them out, and they're still intact, and they're just, you know, they're at some point America is going to run out of interceptors. And I don't know if you saw this, but the PEDOG regime in America like called its defense manufacturers, heads of its defense manufacturing industry, in for like an emergency meeting to say, we need more missiles, we need more stuff, like come on, make it happen. But I was listening to something earlier saying that it's very well demanding that, but there's a lot of a very expensive gear that goes into this stuff, you know, like certain gases and certain rare earth elements and guidance systems and radar systems and optics and all the rest of it that has to go into this missile production. Meanwhile, you know, Iran can get like a cheap Chinese lawnmower engine, stick it in a fiberglass Shahed drone shell, put a bit of explosive on the tip of it and just launch it wherever it wants, you know, within a few hundred mile radius, which is enough to cover the Gulf states and the Strait of Hormuz and all this oil production that Europe relies on and lots of other people rely on, and it's going to, you know, destabilize all these countries that surround it.
So, there's a psychological aspect of them just doing the drip, 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 dropping, you know, wave after wave of missiles on the Israelis. That's definitely going to be wearing the Israelis down. And also, let's say they absolutely opened up and dropped every missile that they had on Tel Aviv and the surrounding areas. Well, in that situation, the Israelis would come out and enact the Samson option, wouldn't they? Samson option, and just, you know, destroy them with their own nuclear weapons. So that obviously they're not going to feel like they can just drop everything on them at once, because they don't want to force them into that corner where they say, all right, well, we're doomed anyway.
Well, the other thing to remember is for Iran, the people in Iran and the government in Iran understands this is like a fight for survival. Like I said earlier, if they lose now, if they fail in this defense of their nation, they turn into a failed state. Israel has free reign, and MI6 and the CIA have free reign to just fund all sorts of horrible, like disgusting groups like ISIS and like the Kurds and everyone else to come and storm their country and make it into a living hellhole, just like they've done with Syria and Iraq and Libya. So they understand this is a fight for their survival. So everything, they've got to bend their entire will to doing this. Israel and America can stop any time and can be, you know, and can be forced to their knees if their civilian populations demand it. You know, dropping cluster munitions on Tel Aviv is like a terror tactic. Well, I mean, terror in like air quotes, right? But at some point, the Israeli people, the Jews in Israel, are going to have had enough of air raid sirens and cluster munitions raining on their heads, and are going to demand that it ends one way or another. And this is what happened in the 12-day war. I mean, if you listen to shills and like pedo Jew media, you would think that Iran lost a 12-day war, but it was Israel who cried off, who'd taken enough punishment from everything I can see, and it's only a matter of time. I mean, if Iran can sustain what it's doing, you know, the Iron Dome is not stopping a giant like cluster warhead that, like you said, drops 60 submunitions on the city in a suburb somewhere. They're going to cry uncle and they're going to bend. They're going to bend the knee to Iran. Meanwhile, Iran can't stop, and it simply can't. Otherwise, it fails. And I'm sure almost everyone in the country understands that.
This is like a boxing match where the other side controls the bell. You know, you've got Mike Tyson there and he's got the bell. He chooses when the match ends. You don't want to give it everything you've got and gas out too early, because it might go on, you know, another 5 minutes. So they are happy to let this draw out. And everything that the Americans and the Israelis has done has all been about, let's, you know, go in there with the alpha strike. Let's drop as much on them as we can. Let's take out this. Let's take out that. And then, you know, we'll just walk away and say mission successful. You know, we can walk away now. And the Iranians are like, no, we're not surrendering. We're going to keep on fighting, because as time continues, you know, it gets more and more in their favor. What they don't want to do is say, right, you know, let's have a ceasefire. And, you know, 3 months, 6 months down the line, it starts all over again. They're better off just continuing it now.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, this is, like I said, this is a long time in the making. This is a long-term plan of Israel's to destroy and destabilize Iran. So if there's a ceasefire, if this stops, it's going to be back on again at some point. And, you know, in the same way that a Gaza ceasefire isn't really a ceasefire. And at some point, Israel's going to move on Gaza again and try and wipe those people out. So I think the Iranians understand that, you know. Well, hopefully they understand that. So we'll see what happens.
Well, it is interesting, because they haven't begged, have they? They haven't begged and they haven't cucked. I think they know there is no negotiations. That's one of the big problems earlier that we talked about, though. You know, when you make it so negotiation is meaningless, you essentially do put people with their backs to the wall. You know, if you've got a guy, you know, stood in his house, you know, with a pistol, and the police are like, look, let's negotiate. But you know that when the police come through that door, they're going to shoot you no matter what. At that point, what are you going to do? Is it going to be fight to the death, blaze of glory time? Or is it going to be, well, I'll spend 12 hours negotiating only to be shot in the head anyway? At that point, you are creating an interesting sort of situation where fundamentally the American word is good for nothing. And the only answer is to fight to the death. And look, you know, without going into World War II, many, many Germans surrendered in good faith, believing that they were going to be treated like human beings, that they were going to be treated honorably, that surrendering to the Americans would be the right thing, that they would go home, that they would be treated, you know, as prisoners of war. And then they were brutalized and starved to death. I mean,
or sent to Russia as slaves, you know.
Yeah.
Even starved on the banks of the Rhine, or sent to Russia as slaves. Yeah, you shouldn't imagine that you're going to be treated fairly if you surrender to these people. They've shown, as we discussed earlier, they've shown that they've got no honor. They've shown that they're dishonorable people, and they don't treat civilians well. Those are the lessons that should be taken from this.
They protest for their right to rape captives when their own people have been caught on video, you know, sodomizing prisoners like Gazans that they've captured. They protest and don't say it didn't happen out in the street. They turn out in the street to protest and say we should be allowed to sodomize them. Is there any other country in the world where you would get that?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about Trump, and this is sort of just one of my sort of notes on this, is that Trump came in as this, you know, art of the deal, wanting to put world peace on the table, get America out of the foreign wars that have dogged it for some time. And essentially, what we've actually seen is quite the opposite. Trump actually does seem to be, and I don't, this isn't meant to be a compliment, by the way, but it probably comes off as a little bit of a compliment. But he does seem to be sort of the ultimate Zog warlord, doesn't he? Trump, as a guy, as a mad sort of emperor, stood, you know, addressing his troops, does seem to be a role that he slips into far more easily and readily than the role of peacemaker. Now, I've seen him in these interviews, I've seen him talking about future operations. You know, I've seen the way he really does love having this power and being able to tell other nations, you know, to bow to him or else. And that's what he's saying, really, with Iran. You know, you'll do what I say, or I'm going to completely raise you to the ground. Now, saying that, do you think there has ever been a more philo-Semitic president? And following this, do you think this will change the way Americans vote in the future?
I doubt it. And I, you know, there may have been more philo-Semitic presidents, but certainly not in our time. Or I mean, our time is in a time when I've been an adult. I think I was 12 at the time when the first Gulf War started, when Bush rolled into Iraq and dragged Blair in and dragged the rest of the British people in. But it's hard to imagine a more philo-Semitic president. And I think part of the problem is, well, I guess, maybe it's not a problem for them, although it might turn out to be, who knows, depending on how this thing goes, is that more and more people were just nakedly seeing it as that. It's like, why, what possible reason could the American people, like the people in America, have for engaging in this like terminal war with Iran? What possible cause do the British people have against the people of Iran? You know, flimsy excuses like, oh, they're a terrorist nation and, you know, they might at some point have a nuke. this just doesn't cut it. This isn't a reason that sensible people would launch wars against people and go on these destructive campaigns against people.
And so the fact that Sunni Pakistanis rape children, so we need to fight against...
Yeah, we need to fight a Persian Shia country. Yeah, absolute lunacy. But people generally understand more now that this is just Jews. This is a war for Jews. It's a war for Israel. And Trump is like deeply, deeply friends with the Jewish pedophile who was the mover and shaker for the evil Jewish pedophile regime. This is their guy. You know, he is their guy, and he's the guy who's going to see this done. Not for you, not for your family, not for the American infrastructure, not for the home country and what it means for the future of America, but for Israel and for his Jewish handlers. And people, I think, understand that. More and more people understand that, which is why this war is so unpopular.
We see more and more people waking up to Jewish power every day. And in America, I mean, you see mainstream leftists like Anna Kasparian from The Young Turks goes out and just says, the Goyim are waking up, deal with it. And, you know, that's amazing to see. And it's a great thing. But at the end of the day, there's no one for them to vote for. The two-party system in America is so entrenched. They're not going to have that option anytime soon to actually get out of it. I mean, you're just going to have a continuation of the same thing where you have presidents get elected and have lower and lower approval ratings, but the people just won't believe it. The people
and there's,
just
like
won't
you
believe
said,
any of what
there's
they
no
say.
Other choice. And, no, and I'll remind you, you know, Mark was saying that President Trump ran on like a no foreign intervention, no foreign wars ticket. Certainly in 2016 he did. But every president has done that. And most of the prime ministers and most of the regimes in this country have run on the same kind of we're not for foreign wars. And yet every time there's a foreign war on behalf of Israel and the Jews, these people snap too. And all of a sudden it's, well, this war is justified. And, you know, this is a terrorist regime and Syria used sarin gas on its people and Iran is a terrorist state and Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. So these people know that foreign wars aren't popular and, you know, foreign wars with thin justifications, but foreign wars where there is literally no justification apart from the Jews want us to do this are extremely unpopular and burn through the veil that these people use to hide what they do and kind of hide the levers they pull in order to get what they want.
That's very interesting. And I do concur. I don't think there is anyone else to vote for, but I'm not really here to correct anyone tonight. I think everyone's made excellent points, but you are actually wrong that it was just 2016. There are pictures floating around that I've actually shared showing that Trump, you know, with Trump and Vance stood together, you know, and it's, you know, the kind of text around them is the peace ticket, you know, saying you're voting for us, you're voting for peace. This is what they ran on this time as well. And Trump did make these huge sort of overtures to the Nobel Committee that he wanted the Nobel Peace Prize, that he was going to stop these wars, which obviously he hasn't done.
I think I'm probably guilty of paying less attention to the Trump campaign in 2022 than I was in 2016. But yeah, I can well believe it. And I've seen that in headlines quoted, you know, for the peace ticket and Trump lambasting Obama on Twitter at the time saying, Obama's going to start a war in Iran because he's such a terrible negotiator and he sucks at being a peaceful president. And it's like, yeah, you know, so many years later, you're the guy. You're the guy these people have activated to get this done.
Well, indeed. And the next point, because we're sort of getting towards what do we think's going to happen. But before we do that, I think one of the interesting things about this is we've seen. So there are a lot of, what can I call them, shitbag influencers like Tommy Robinson, Douglas Murray, Andrew Neil. I despise Andrew Neil. Fat, worthless toad. The day he has sort of a gigantic coronary as he sat eating his sort of duck pate in his, you know, on his terrace in the south of France will be a good day for the world. That guy is always on the wrong side of everything. He wants to attack Iran, wanted all the COVID restrictions. I can't remember him ever saying anything good. He is scum of the earth. But on the other side, we have seen this interesting bipartisan pushback. We've seen Tucker Carlson, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Thomas Massie, Anna Kasparian. There has been this mass awakening to Israel. I mean, Tucker Carlson stood in front of Turning Point USA, getting a standing ovation for saying, you know, Israel needs to get out of American politics. That is seismic. You know, he is still, you know, the biggest American political voice in terms of being an influencer. I think this is incredible. Now, I was somebody that was quite happy for Trump to get in for a couple of reasons, but one of the reasons being that I believed that this would bring things to a head. I believed that the Trump regime would be the regime that accelerated things to a point where numerous people who had previously been extremely philo-Semitic would end up coming out, breaking ranks, and there would be a mainstream acceptance of our points. I remember saying that, actually. I was briefly invited on War Strike of all streams the night of the election. And I was like, look, this isn't a bad thing. Don't have a cow over this, basically. This is something that may well bring us certain benefits. And I think that we are, you know, sort of seeing this to a large degree. Now, what do you guys think about this? Because it's been, I can't really remember the last time we've actually seen such a bipartisan move against Israel. And it's not just the ones I've mentioned, but I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene has been incredible. Tucker Carlson's leading the charge with young right-wing males and females. Turning Point USA, which used to be absolutely zogged, is now a hive of like counter-Semitism, if you like. And on top of all of that, having the absolutely delightful and wife-ready material known as Anna Kasparian, she's absolutely perfect. You know, coming out
brown and, for me.
What? What did you say, Euro?
What did you say?
It's a Euro? Bit brown for me.
Nah, get out, boot him. Wait, from the street.
Do you know what? Do you know what? Euro's got this thing right where you show any girl who's got the mildest amount of tan, and he goes into some kind of like tailspin, as if like white women have never ever set foot out of the house.
But are Armenians white?
This one is. This one certainly is.
This one. If she's anti-Semitic, she's white. Okay, fair enough.
The question is, Euro, are you white? Because the fact you've asked this of our lady in chief,
perfect queen.
Yeah, a perfect queen means maybe you're
not as big a simp as you are, mate.
Mate, there's nothing simpy about loving Anna.
It's a justified simpery.
It's justified simply, yeah, you know. And you know why I like Anna as well? Is when she gets angry, she just doesn't hold back, does she? She's one of those people, you know, sometimes watching somebody get really angry.
There was a clip of her on Piers Morgan, and she was like yelling at these like Jews. There were like six of them on the panel, and I think they were all Jews apart from her and Piers Morgan. And she's like yelling and screaming at them because they're trying to dissemble and, you know, do whataboutery about the killing in Gaza and the killing kids in Iran and stuff. And she's really letting them have it. And she's screaming at them. There was some like boomer in the Facebook comments, like, oh, I tried to watch it, but I couldn't take the screeching. I put underneath it, I was like, I would listen to her scream about Jews in my ear all night.
I mean, yeah.
Look, that is how I feel. I feel that like she has come out, and when she does it, she does it. So if you're screaming like some mad sort of disheveled, for want of a better term, Karen, and you're sort of mad because there was only seven.
Karen is an anti-slur.
Well, it is, but Karen can also, you know what I mean? You get some women who will go crackers over like the fact there's only seven olives in their, you know, olive pasta, and the menu shows eight or something, and they throw an absolute fit over it. But the way she blows up, it's so attractive. She's like, don't give me this, you disgusting Zionist pig. You make me sick. And she's enunciating every one of her words. And she's not holding back either. She's like, you child-killing monsters. That's what it's really like.
It's like righteous fury at the people she's like put up against on these panel shows.
Exactly. And when you're watching it, it's extremely attractive. It's not sort of, you know, like I said, I know Karen is a bit of an anti-white slur, but it's not Karen-esque. It's not like a, you know, an overly, you know, liberal white woman who's outraged because, you know, of something minor that normal people are like, look, just pull yourself together. This is, you know, the way she does it, I find it to be absolutely, well, it's cracking, isn't it? I love it. Anyway, that's enough glazing of Anna Kasparian. look, can there ever be enough glazing of Anna Kasparian? That would be a, that could be a 2-hour stream in itself, guys.
There is for Euro, apparently. I mean, Euro's not on the Kasparian train here, unfortunately. Maybe we'll have to have a word with him after the stream.
We have to. You mean a beating?
You're going to a re-education camp.
After the show in the green room, we give him a kicking. So what do you think of this bipartisan movement, though? I find it refreshing. I like it. And it's got real gravitas because, look, I was on the David Duke show earlier. And obviously, I work with David probably more than anybody else in the world, for better or worse. And I love David. He's a real character. He can be a bit difficult at times, but he's a real character. But sadly, David does not have the influence he once had. And I'm not saying that to sort of mock David or deride David. I'm just saying that as a statement of fact. But somebody like Anna Kasparian does have that power. She does have that, you know, gravitas. But so does Thomas Massie and Marjorie Taylor Greene. You know, Tucker Carlson, absolutely massive. And you're watching these people tear in to, you know, the Zionist cause, an attack, you know, these war hawk Jews. It is very refreshing. I mean, well, for me, it is anyway. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I love it. I mean, how does this make you feel after all the years of being in the wilderness? And look, it's being in the wilderness is something that I am still very much in the wilderness, despite all my hard work over the years, despite my incredible consistency. Like, if I'm not the perfect guy, okay, not by a long means. I am very good at debates, but I'm not the perfect guy. I have my foibles. I screw up sometimes.
Not good at controlling your temper.
I was going to joke there by exploding at you. I'm not brilliant at controlling my temper, but I am. One thing you've got to say for me is that throughout all these years, I have been extremely consistent in what I've stood for. Now, when it comes down to it, seeing these people, for me, anyway, come out and be sort of so, completely, anti-Israel. It's the first time I've ever seen it. And it's not just relying on, and I said, this isn't to knock David, but it's not just to rely on me and David Duke making the point anymore. You know, these points are being made by these more mainstream individuals who've got serious gravitas. And I actually like that. I think it's something that I think is really important. And seeing Anna Kasparian, seeing all these others doing it, I think this has taken our message to a new crowd. And it's interesting to see that there are people all over the political system who have had enough of Israel.
Yeah, and I think having this kind of... it's not perfect. The things they say aren't perfect, right? And the problem isn't just Israel. And I think most people get that. And this isn't to kind of pee on your cornflakes, Mark, but even the things they're saying do give an amount of headroom for anyone who's less sizable and less influential from them to kind of push those boundaries a little bit more. And there is further to push. I mean, we shouldn't... we shouldn't be coming around the campfire at this stage to stretch your wilderness analogy. We should be trying to, you know, we should still be in the wilderness, saying that, you know, telling the truth and putting the final truth to it. Because like I said, the things they're saying, you know, are anti-Israel, which is like 90% of the way there. Right. And, like I said, giving headroom for more, not extreme, that's not the word, but for a greater and more deep understanding to come forth. And I think that you are going to see from this war with Iran, you're going to see a tranche of like politicians and people emerge who are willing to say these things. And, you know, sure, amongst those people, there are going to be shills and they're going to be subversive people. But at some point, it just becomes like a political football. It will just become a political football, whether you support Israel and whether you're going to do their bidding. I mean, one of the disappointing things with Rupert Lowe is he hasn't really come out against, he hasn't made a statement against Israel, which I'm sure none of us really expect, but now would be the perfect time for someone in his position to make that leap. We haven't seen it yet, but I think this just, you know, pushes that football a little bit further down the road, you know, pushes the can a little bit further down the road to give space for that to happen.
I think every day that Rupert Lowe goes out and doesn't support Israel, even if he won't explicitly say that he's against them, obviously that's giving us room and whatnot. But another thing, talking about obviously the Goyim waking up and Trump, I think it is great that we see all these people realizing the extent of Jewish power. And I think Trump especially is to thank for it, because he is just so... he is so openly philo-Semitic in a way that no previous president, even if they love Jews as much as he does, they just wouldn't do it so openly. You know, he goes out there and declares himself the king of Israel, and he says this, that, and the other. And it's, again, with, you know, the attack on Iran and the thing with Venezuela, there's not even a pretense anymore. It's just, we're doing this because it's in our interest, and we're attacking Iran because that's what we want to do, you know? There's not even the pretense anymore.
I don't like to cut across people, because we've all been pretty good at not cutting across people, but I just wanted to further your point. You know, when Trump does things which are so sort of egregious that you sort of wonder why he's saying them. Like when he said, oh, you know, the Adelsons basically bought me the White House, so whenever they want to just walk in and ask for a policy to be passed, what am I going to do? It's the bloody Adelsons. They gave me about $500 million. You know, how are you going to say no to the people who gave you $500 million? Come on, guys. Let's get things going. And you're thinking to yourself, are you actually saying this? Are you actually saying to people, look, the Adelsons bought me the White House, so then when they want a policy passing, I just bring them in and say, what do you want? And when they say, oh, I want this, I just give it to them. Most people would know which bits not to say out loud. You know, it's like when you were a kid, your mum was like, you know, did you clean up the house? You'd be like, yeah, I did. But you wouldn't be, well, actually, I spilt the water from the big vase, partially flooded the living room, spent ages dabbing it up, and have hid the stain under the mat. Because there's part of it that you don't say out loud, isn't there? There's part that you say out loud. But Trump, he says it all out loud. And it becomes sort of so almost jarring to hear him say it, because for years we've heard that politicians are bought, they're sold, you know, powerful foreign forces pay for politicians to do their bidding. And here's Trump just honestly saying, well, that's exactly what happens. I do it all the time. The Adelsons basically funded me and I did everything for them. So when they want a policy, I give it them. Well, you don't say that out loud, do you? You say, you know, the Adelsons are, you know, an important part of what we're hoping to do, and no one has undue influence over me, but I'm happy to hear from him. He doesn't do any of that. There's no beating around the bush. He basically says, Jews got me in, and when they want a policy passing, I give it to them. I mean, is that refreshing to hear? For me, it is, because it confirms everything that we've always said.
Yeah, he is known for slurping up the juju cum, as someone put in the chat earlier. I think the worrying thing is, I guess it's not worrying. I mean, it's interesting. So there was like this groundswell of JQ awareness, like Israel hatred, after October the 7th because of what Israel was doing to Gaza. And then, you know, the media gets to declare there's a ceasefire, Gaza's over, we can look away now. We can look away from the fact that Israel's been like bombing hospitals and stuff. Because of the nature of the news cycle and everything else, people let it drop. And then this big orange slave, Jew slave, Trump, comes along and starts a war with Iran, like totally on behalf of his Jewish handlers in Israel. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, right, my awareness is shaking again. Like, now there's just another thing that's like cannot be ignored, where we have to like bring out this question again to the public and try and explain why this war for Israel isn't anything to do with Jews and is secretly about Russia or whatever else it is, you know? So, yeah, I mean, awareness rising.
So we pretty much wrapped up a lot of the things we were going to talk about. And we've already said that, you know, Israel has been proven through this not to be invincible. And I think that's one of the key things here. At one point, Israel touted the Iron Dome. It touted their invincibility. I think this has shown something that's very interesting. It's highlighted that America is Israel's lapdog, but it's also highlighted that without America, Israel couldn't exist. And that's important, I think, for two reasons. There's this symbolic idea of Israel being this invincible outpost in the Middle East that the Iron Dome protects, and they can stand alone if necessary. I think Israel have been really undermined here, not just from a moral perspective, but from the view that they can be hurt, which is important. You know, one of the big things, if you're ever in some kind of conflict facing what appears to be an immovable or unstoppable enemy, to show that that enemy is in fact fallible and can be hurt is very, very important. And although we've hardly seen Israel, you know, sink into the Mediterranean, I do think the strikes on Israel have been significant from the point of view that it has shown them to be scared. If they don't have the West on their side, they can't defend themselves.
Well, it's like with October 7th, you know, when October 7th happened, it showed the world that they're not all powerful. They're not all knowing, you know, they're not always just going to win because they've got everything on lockdown. Their power does have limits. And, you know, there's some amount of white nationalists who come out and say, oh, no, they let that happen. You know, they let that happen on purpose.
I say that.
They have a reason to do this. But actually, you know, it's like you're unwilling to believe that they just screwed up that badly.
Look, I'm not going to get into a big debate, but I actually believe they let that happen. I believe that that was part of their plan and gave them this imperative to do what they did in Gaza. However, I think Iran's a different kettle of fish. I think that what we're seeing with Iran here is something fundamentally much more damaging for them, because they have nothing to gain by letting Iran smash through the Iron Dome. They have nothing that they can say, well, this gives us the moral imperative to do X, because in the case of Iran, they've already done X, haven't they? X has already been committed to. It's already been carried out. So I think there's different things here. But look, let's wrap this up. And we're going to wrap this up before we do the questions and answers. If anyone wants to super chat, if you've enjoyed the stream, please consider sending a super chat. But we're going to wrap this up with, obviously, we've said this is for the Greater Israel Project, and we've talked about the political ramifications around the world for America, for Russia, for China, for future conflicts. But one thing we haven't talked about is the political ramifications here in Britain. Now, obviously, Starmer hasn't embroiled himself, and he's made the right choice in that case, but probably for the wrong reasons. Rather than doing this because he doesn't want to serve Israel, he's done this because he doesn't want to turn the Muslim bloc vote against him any further, because he fears losing the next general election. But what we can see here, or what I see here, is a major problem with refugees. And they're talking about potentially Telegraph that stated this. The calculation is that 2.5 million people will be displaced from the region due to this conflict. At the present time, that number could obviously rise. And they're all going to be coming to Europe. They're not going to be going to Israel. And I've always described this as sort of the twin evils of Israel. On one hand, Israel menaces, murders, maims, terrorizes states in the Middle East for its own gain and to maintain dominance in the region. However, the blowback is never for Israel. The blowback of all this ends up hitting Western nations who take the refugees or the people that are displaced. And I think that's the final piece of the puzzle, that the Greater Israel Project makes Israel more powerful, but by extension, due to the knock-on effect, it weakens the West. It pushes us closer to a demographic shift that will be unrecoverable and fundamentally takes us a step nearer to being a minority in our ancestral homelands.
Yeah, destabilizing its immediate neighbors, like I said earlier, destabilizing its immediate neighbors with missiles and bombs and gay ops and all the rest of it is a short timescale. But destabilizing European countries with mass immigration and kind of ethnic cleansing and all the rest of that, that's still just destabilization. It's just on a longer timescale. And I alluded to this earlier, but the Israeli gay ops and the CIA and Mossad and MI6 operation, well, I mean, it was the open British government was just aiding like terrorists in Libya overthrowing Gaddafi. Gaddafi had an agreement with Italy where Italy would pay him to stop, you know, just endless floods of migrants crossing the Mediterranean into Europe. And, you know, Israel, uncaring that was in place or seeing that actually destroying that was a good thing because it helped destabilize everything, not just Europe, but topple Libya, decided to enact, you know, plans against Gaddafi that ended with him, like I said, with a bayonet up his bum, dragged out into the street. And that led to the migration crisis in 2015, which is ongoing today. And I just posted in the private chat there, because I just looked this up, Morgoth's Law, which was spoken by Morgoth himself. No matter where the conflict is in the world, the refugees coming to Europe will be fighting age black and brown men. And that's going to hold true for this conflict. Now, that's, you know, that might be coincidental in other cases, but certainly with Iran, this is the double, not the double-edged sword, but like the win-win situation for Israel. They get to destabilize nations by direct war against their like direct competitors, but they also get to destabilize their so-called allies, you know, in terms of European nations and America, with all these displaced people who then, you know, through their human rights groups and refugee groups and these kind of NGOs get to set up migration routes into the countries and who are supposedly their allies that they help destabilize. The knock-on for politics in this country, unfortunately, there won't be much because we don't have much of a choice. And you know, if reform was in power at the moment, it would probably be just balls out gung ho for Israel. So what choice do you have in this country? I mean, it's probably less than anywhere else.
I will say, though, I think Euro is right in what he said. Every day that Rupert Lowe spends not endorsing Israel is a victory from our point of view. You know, I know that might sound like a cucky thing to say, but it has been so long since we've had anybody in any form of position of genuine power, which he has, who hasn't immediately been a slave to Israel. And it's one of the things that Tommy Robinson's been quite upset, actually, by a number of things Rupert Lowe has said and done. I don't know if you saw, but Tommy Robinson said, you know, Rupert Lowe needs to clarify whether black people can be British. You know, Rupert Lowe needs to clarify his position on all these things. Well, I find that very interesting because that suggests that Tommy and his handlers are getting quite nervous that, you know, Rupert isn't going to be the Zio lapdog they hoped he would.
Yeah, the kind of the cucked Sivnat stuff that always bends towards this like piss weak conservatism, as we've seen with reform, where it just turns out they're just as I mean, they're not really even civic nationalists, they're just conservatives in that anyone's British, anyone who steps foot on this island is British. So, yeah, I mean, funnily enough, Tommy, those questions from Tommy Robinson he tried to put to Rupert Lowe were in the wake of, like, the Iran war starting and Rupert Lowe not coming out in support of Israel. And all of a sudden, here you've got Tommy Robinson popping up, like, fresh from snorting up lines of coke on a mirror somewhere in America, asking him about the same, well, pulling the same gay ops that he tried with the BNP all those years ago, which you know about very well, Mark.
And after hopping off his private jet with his son, who's posting about it on Instagram while he begs for money from poor white people who haven't got a dime to scrape together.
Yeah, Tommy Robinson, just to reiterate, is absolute scum. He is scum. And he doesn't even, everything out of Tommy Robinson's mouth is like a Jewish handler somewhere. And that has become more and more clear. There's no like intersection of lines from real dissidency in this country and in the West and Tommy Robinson. This is like a literal Jewish mouthpiece being paid by Israel to say the things he does. And if you, you know, if you think there's some part of Tommy that's still good or some part of him that's still worth listening to, then you simply haven't been paying attention and you need to, I don't know, get with the program or get your head right. Because he's evil, he's terrible, and he's a scumbag.
I concur. So I think we've had a pretty robust chat. We're going to do the super chats in a couple of seconds. If you want a super chat, please do. But I'll say this. I think in conclusion, I've said this many times before, but the Judeo-American Empire is the greatest threat to the world. And I've said
this. They are the great Satan.
But it's not just the greatest threat, is it, to white people? Now, we obviously are, you know, fundamentally our thoughts are for white people. That's the most important thing for us, that we look after people of European descent. However, it's not just people of European descent that suffer under the Judeo-American state. Obviously, Arabs suffer immensely. And a lot of the problems created by the Judeo-American state's actions, such as these unnecessary wars, these toppling of sovereign regimes, the murder of government leaders in foreign countries like, you know, Colonel Gaddafi. And look, when we say this, we're not saying that Colonel Gaddafi is our hero or that we loved everything he did, but he was stopping millions of people passing through his country and entering Europe. And I'm sure that when he was toppled, there were many people within the Israeli regime and many leading Jews in America and Europe that were very happy that there was going to be even more migrants headed to Europe. And I believe that the only real way that the world can achieve freedom is for the Judeo-American Empire to fall. I don't know whether you guys agree with that. Obviously, have 30 seconds each to sum up, or a minute, or whatever you need.
That's totally correct. And that is the line of, like I said a second ago, real dissidency and this kind of rightoid, right-wing, you know, edgy conservatism. Like you said, the Judeo-American Empire is the threat, is the problem. And if you're not willing to say that, if you're not willing to like cheer on its losses, then you're not on the same level as you should be. I mean, you're not where you should be. And I'm sure everyone listening to this is pretty much there. But those are the lines. There's not a left-right divide. There's not a, you know, third worldist, whatever it is, divide. It's just you're either hoping for this evil entity to fail, or you're not at this point. But and we're seeing, you know, hopefully we're seeing, you know, part of it failing here, and we're going to see it fail more and more. So that's what I'm looking forward to. Not just that, but the visceral feeling when you, like you said, see a cluster munition raining down on Tel Aviv feels good too. So enjoy it.
White people the world over shall not be free until organized Jewry is disempowered, inshallah.
that was the most concise you've been all night, mate. That's superb. So I think it's been a very, very productive stream this evening, and I think we've talked about a lot of things that people would want us to talk about. And without being boastful, I think that tonight we've kind of hit on more or less every major point, unless we haven't. But I think we put a lot of effort, obviously, into ensuring that we did hit every major talking point tonight. And this was the most comprehensive coverage of this particular issue that anyone will get. So I'm hoping that you guys you know, enjoyed it. And we are going to do the super chats now. So thank you to everyone who has super chatted. And if you haven't, there is obviously still time. And remember, if you do send a financial contribution, it's gratefully received because it's what allows me to keep doing things like this and doing these streams. Anyway, Mr. Skywalker gave $3. Thank you so much. And he said, you and Red Ice were definitely correct about Zog's superior tactical advantage, which I never doubted. Still, Iran and its proxies have fared better than expected, landing hits on Zog's military assets. And he goes on with another $3 and said, it appears Zog is carpet bombing civilian structures in Iran now, as many military bases and missile sites are up to 1,000 feet below ground, very difficult to destroy. Do you think Zog will use ICBMs? I think we've said that actually, that fundamentally we are seeing probably a better sort of defense than people may have initially thought. However, obviously, you know, going up against, you know, the Judeo-American Empire is absolutely not an easy thing to do. They are doing better than thought. And interestingly, the Americans are already resorting to these horrific tactics of bombing civilian structures. Do you think Trump would go as far as using an ICBM?
It's possible. You know, who knows? At every juncture where you think Trump isn't going to do something, you know, sometimes, well, quite often he will just go ahead and do it. The problem with nukes is, one, that's a line that if you cross has real implications if you drop a nuke on a country just because you started a war and are then subsequently losing that war.
If you started a war to stop them having nukes, and then when you lost, you nuked them.
Yeah, it kind of undermines. It's a massive red line. Like I said, you know, probably implications that none of us even can think about at this stage. The second thing is, nukes. For all this talk of tactical nukes, they're a surface weapon. You detonate them above ground, so they don't really in this war against Iran. They don't really have like a tactical purpose, and they would only be used to destroy like surface, like weak, soft civilian targets, like cities. I mean, nukes are designed to be used on cities that are, or like massed troop buildups, which Iran doesn't have. So morally, it would be reprehensible, and tactically, it'd be stupid, although it would literally just be against civilians. To use them in this war would be like against civilian targets.
Yeah, it wouldn't benefit them one bit, and there's no way that Russia and China would not respond to it. And that's not saying that they would launch nukes themselves, but there would have to be some kind of bigger response from them to get more actively involved.
And I think Natty hit the real point here. The only time nukes have ever been used are on civilian targets. They are not a weapon that is used really for military sites. There's all this talk of, oh, well, people have got tactical nukes now, and a tactical nuke does this, and the fallout's not as great. And, you know, we've heard all of these sort of takes before. But fundamentally, the only proven use for a nuke is to be used against a civilian target. That's just the way it is. And I personally believe that if the Americans did this and took it down that route, it would be this fundamental turning point that I'm not sure the world could recover from that. You know, it's happened obviously twice before, and it was horrific what the Americans did to the Japanese. But to do it now, and for America to be doing it because they started the war and it wasn't going their way, I think the world would change in a way that we probably couldn't actually completely understand right now. But I don't think it will go nuclear. Thank you so much for the two super chats, though. Ruins in a Landscape gave $50. Thank you so much for such a generous super chat. Bay of Kings gave $5. Thank you so much, and said, thanks, Mark. It appears Natty's dropped out. One of his devices has come unconnected, it says on the screen. I'm sure he'll be back. Arab Social Nationalist gave $10. Thank you so much. And said, thoughts on the spectacle of the Nigerian leader of the opposition, Olukemi Olufuntu Adegoke Badenoch and Farage, arguing that Starmer hasn't done enough for the Yanks. There is no opposition in the British establishment, nor a whisper of dissent in Parliament. War for Jews unites the establishment. I think this is very, very interesting. And obviously, Badenoch and Farage are looking at what got Trump to power. Now, fundamentally, Farage and Badenoch are both out of power at the moment. And I think they're both kissing up to Israel as much as they can, hoping that that will be their ticket to a Trump-style run at Parliament. And let's face it, although at the moment Farage is the favourite to win the next general election, that can all change, and he is looking at sort of shoring up his position. But Kemi Badenoch is looking at going into a general election where she will be decimated. So it is interesting to see both Badenoch and Farage fighting to see who can be the most philo-Semitic on this particular issue. But I'll say this, and like, this isn't meant to be like a cold way to leave the stream or a black pill at the end or anything of the sort, but there are still an awful lot, and I call them boomers because they generally are from that sort of age bracket. Now, it's not to say all boomers are evil, but there generally is this sort of boomer mentality of, well, bomb them all, you know, get rid of the Arabs. We need to support Israel. They're our greatest ally. And that rhetoric does still appeal to, I would say, a sizable portion of the boomer population.
Yeah, I agree. And because they don't really want to think about it and the implications of it. So they're just like, oh, something else is going on. Oh, to hell with them all. Just blow them all up, bloody Arabs. And that's a cultivated mentality. But that's not an accident that people say things like that and think things like that. This callous, cold, bloodthirsty, you know, mentality that's been instilled in people through, I mean, basically, like a real use of the term racism, where it's like, yeah, Arabs are like dirty brown people. and we need to, and killing them anywhere is good. It's like, well, a normal human being, a moral human being, doesn't actually think that way. And if you've been led into thinking that some like cartoon villain version of like, I don't know, like a Western man is ridiculous and retarded and immoral. And the people who've put that idea in your head have taken a long time to do it, but have succeeded if you come out making statements like that.
And to the extent that it is a naturally occurring phenomenon, it's as a result of having the Pakistani rape gangs that Jewish people and organisations brought here, and having the Sunni Wahhabi terrorists who are created by the funding of Saudi Arabia and Israel's allies.
Oh, yeah. When Israel needed a recruiting ground for ISIS to destabilize Syria, they just used our country. And the overspill where like little girls were getting blown up in concerts or people were getting stabbed on London Bridge, that was acceptable.
That was just a bonus.
That was just like a, you know, little side project for them.
Well, thank you so much, guys. We'll go on to the next super chat. It's from Tomorrow's Victims, who gave $5. Thank you so much. He said, the vast majority of us here in Yankland do not want the stupid war. Cheers to all my UK people. Thank you so much. Some Guy 14 gave $10. Thank you so much. And he subscribed for $10. Well, that's much appreciated. Remember, you can subscribe to me over on Entropy and Rumble, and that means you make a monthly donation. And obviously on Entropy, you can subscribe for any amount, and Rumble is fixed $5. But on Rumble, we've got a good number of subs now, a good number of followers. And if we had sort of 400 or 500 subs, that would just be phenomenal. And obviously, it would really, really help me financially. And it wouldn't really make a massive difference to people, as $5 is what the price of a large can of Red Bull these days. But if enough people did that, it'd make a huge difference to me. We also have one super chat over on Rumble, only one tonight, and it's from ArchiePW07. Thank you so much. He gave $5, and he said, I was all in with Trump, the Great Awakening and all that. He has sold his soul for Israeli gold. No one wins a war, only the people suffer always. Follow the money. Trump is Israel first, it seems. Well, yeah, I mean, I completely agree with that. Trump is Israel first, and Trump is someone who is absolutely committed to Israel, I think, in a way that I'm not sure we've ever seen before. I don't think we've ever seen a president this committed to the state of Israel, which is obviously interesting in itself, you know, to say that, to say we've never had a president that is this committed to Israel. But he certainly is. And at the moment, he is proving his loyalty to that nation to an unbelievable point. And whether this works for him in the long run or not, who knows? But I think it's fair to say that he is risking everything for his loyalty to people who I don't think. And the interesting thing with these people is they did not support him when he was out in the wilderness. One of the interesting things with Trump is when he was saying, look, the election was rigged. Netanyahu was actually the first foreign leader to say to Biden, to congratulate Biden on his victory. Can you remember that? I mean, Trump went mental about that at the time because he thought Netanyahu was his best friend. But it just goes to show Trump isn't actually, well, he doesn't actually have any principles whatsoever, does he? Trump is actually a guy that, you know, the Israelis can kick him. They can treat him like he's their boy, their little dog. And, you know, when it comes down to it, he will take it time and again.
Yeah, I mean, the only difference, just to add, the only difference is how open it is now. I mean, like I said earlier, the other presidents have probably done everything to the detriment of their own people on behalf of Israel. But Trump is just open about it, and everyone gets it, and everyone knows now, and he's just still plowing ahead with it. So there's the difference with this one.
Anything to add, Euro?
No, I think we've covered most of that already.
Okay, well, look, that brings us to the end of the stream. Thank you so much to everyone who has been here. Obviously, if you haven't super chatted and you're watching this on replay, you can donate any time you like on replay. And if you do support these streams, especially these long form discussions, which take a reasonable amount of time to prepare and we put a lot of effort into, please do consider sending a super chat, and we will keep doing them. Anyway, guys, if you want to say good night, we'll go around the group and then we will wrap things up.
Night, guys. I have been looking at the chat, and there's been a lot of like pretty decent discussion in there. So I appreciate everyone who's been here, and you know, it's good getting all this down and talking about this, because a lot of this stuff is beyond the kind of political divide that you see in this country between, you know, even nationalists who say things like, oh, I don't care about either side and they can kill each other, and that's like the best you can hope for out of supposed right wingers and dissidents in this country. But I think a sober analysis and a sober talk about what it all means and what's happening is worthwhile. So thanks to you two, and thanks to the chat for turning up, and I'll see you around.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's been a good talk with both of you. Obviously, we do get a bit of this chat going on with the A team, which I'm no longer going to be with because Sam's back, unless I'm a stand-in when someone's away. But it was good to talk about this stuff. And, you know, maybe going forward, I will get back into doing some sort of show again on my own. Maybe I'll revive Tassob. Who knows?
Be very happy if you revived Tassob, buddy. So look forward to it.
Well, look, thank you to both of you. It's been a great chat. And I just want to wrap things up by saying thank you to everybody. Well, thank you first to Natty and Euro for giving up their evenings. You know, obviously we enjoy doing this. We're friends in real life, and I think we've got pretty good chemistry, and I think it has been a pretty entertaining stream. I would also like to say a huge thank you to everyone who donated. Remember, you can donate at any point you wish. And finally, a massive thank you to everybody who tuned in. We had really good attendance tonight, lots of people tuning in, lots of people enjoying the stream, and a really, really sort of quick moving, interesting discussion on both the Odyssey and the Rumble chat. So thank you to everyone who participated. Anyway, I won't be back on Sunday. It was unlikely I'd be back on Sunday because it was my son's birthday this week and we're having a little party for him on Sunday. So that will likely be something that may run on, and I don't really want to be rushing through that to do a Sunday night film review or stream. I probably just want to enjoy a little bit of family time, which I'm sure no one begrudges me, and I will be doing that. Anyway, I'll be back on Wednesday for Patriotic Weekly Review. Until then, thank you, everybody. Good night, and look after yourselves.